This is Kenneth Banghart reporting from New York and suggesting you switch from hots to cool cigarettes for a fresh new experience in smoking enjoyment. Because cools give you a clean, cool taste in your mouth, make your throat feel smooth, refreshed all day long. Coming up, an important medical report, a circling jet bomber, quiet around the house, salami and diamonds, the story of a foxy situation. And here's a story about a big switch. A big switch that can change the entire picture for you as far as smoking goes. Especially if you've noticed a kind of smoked-out feeling at the end of the day, or if your throat feels rough and raw. That's the time to make the big switch from hot cigarettes to cools. Every week, more and more smokers are discovering what a wonderful thing it is to have a clean, cool taste in your mouth all day long, and a throat that feels smooth and refreshed hour after hour. So when you find your present brand tasting harsh and flat toward evening, and your throat feeling hot and dry, make the big switch from hots to cools. Better still, buy a pack of cools tomorrow morning and wake up to a whole new world of smoking pleasure.
If your throat is feeling hot, here's the thing that helps a lot. Switch from hots to
cools. As Willie the Penguin says, smoke
cools.
Smoke
cools.
King size or regular.
And now the news. Washington, the report today of his six doctors that President Eisenhower should be able to carry on an active life as president for another 5 to 10 years, is being taken by many as the best sign yet he will run for re-election. Says Republican National Chairman Leonard Hall, the decision is in his hands and his own feelings and judgment will be the determining factors. The president may make the decision on a visit to a Georgia plantation starting tomorrow. The New York Stock Exchange had closed before the doctor's report came, but San Francisco and Los Angeles markets reacted with heavy buying orders and a rise in prices. Edwards Air Force Base, California, after circling 5 hours to use up gasoline when landing gear failed to operate, the three-man crew of a Navy jet bomber parachuted to Earth safely today, and the $2 million plane was shot down over the desert by jet fighters. The disabled plane had started out in the attempt to set a cross-country speed record. From NBC's Irving Arlevine in Moscow, the absence of anti-Western invective in a long speech by Communist Party Chief Khrushchev to a party convention today might have been meant to counteract his recent intemperate speeches that aroused world antagonism. Washington, back from a visit to guided missile research projects in Alabama and Florida, Defense Secretary Wilson said tonight, people generally don't realize how far along we are in development of 1,500-mile missiles, even more fantastic weapons. In Reading, Pennsylvania, Mrs. Charles Zyber put her 5 children in the hospital today. Tomorrow, they will all have their tonsils out, says she. It sure is going to be quiet around the house for a few days. Hollywood, Al Teitelbaum, leading furrier to movie stars, has been arrested on charges he staged a phony robbery of his fur place in order to claim $135,000 insurance. He denies it. Government report, the United States produced a record $387 billion worth of goods and services in 1955, over 7% more than 54. Capitol Hill, a House committee has been told that customs agents would rather catch an immigrant with a salami in his suitcase than discover a diamond smuggler. Reason? The salami could bring in foreign diseases that might get a foothold. Toronto, police investigating the death of an elderly Chinese man in a squalid Skid Row room found today that he left $65,000 in the bank. And these last lines. In Aberford, Scotland today, they told of a fox that hid in a hedge while hounds and hunters on horses raced past him. Over much Scottish hillock and dale, the hunters and dogs they did sail, unaware that behind anyone could find the wily fox following their trail. This is Kenneth Banghart suggesting you switch from hots to cools for that smooth, refreshed feeling in your throat, that clean, cool taste in your mouth. Buy cools, king size or regular. Goodbye, everyone.
Hear the story of Grantland Rice, sports writer, on Biography and Sound next over most NBC stations. In just a moment, Biographies in Sound. But first, tomorrow is another special day filled with fact and fun that's NBC's weekday. From a stimulating interview with gifted photographer Edward Steichen to the music of composer Johnny Green, you'll find something to suit your every mood. Homemaking hints and food news help simplify your household duties. And the fascinating dramatization of James Hilton's novel Lost Horizon brings all the thrill and imagination of a fine novel right into your own home. Join Margaret Truman and Mike Wallace tomorrow for a day of top entertainment on NBC's Weekday. Now stay tuned for Biographies and Sound on NBC.
The National Broadcasting Company presents They Knew Grantland Rice, another in a series of Biographies in Sound.
And his game will be the same.
Outlined against a blue-gray October sky, the four horsemen rode again.
Dynamite, dynamite.
The ghost of Bella Woods defeats the phantom of St. Paul.
He loved the games that he wrote about, and he was a student of everything that he wrote about. I suppose that's one reason that he was such a great writer.
Within the next 55 transcribed minutes, the voices of Gene Tunney, Clarence Buddington Kellen, Bill Cora, Tris Speaker, Jim Crowley, Red Smith, and many other famous names in the world of sports, letters, and business. They all knew Grantland Rice, the gentle man who brought sports into millions of American homes. For this biography in sound on the Dean of Sports Writers, your narrator is the Dean of the nation's sportscasters, Tom Manning.
I want you to take a little trip with me, back to the time when the Saturday football game was the biggest thing in your life. When your heart could be thrilled by victory or broken by defeat. Can you go back to that part of your life? Can you see those crowds again, hear those bands, feel the excitement when that opening kickoff spirals down the field? Oh, it's hard to go back, isn't it? Maybe it's too far behind you. Maybe you've had some hard going since those days. You lose that old college spirit in the school of hard knocks. But don't you really wish sometimes that you could recapture the spirit of your youth when deep down inside you there was real meaning to those words like fair play and team spirit and sportsmanship? This is the story of a man who lived by those words all his life. Henry Grantland Rice, 50 years, a sports reporter.
Yet, when you think of Granny now, you think of him not as a writer, but as a wonderful, wonderful person.
Fred Russell, sports editor of the Nashville Banner.
He set a pattern and a tone that never will you be able to put the true value on. It's just immeasurable what he meant. It would be very difficult to put into words what the Grantland Rice tradition is. I guess if you reduced it to the simplest terms, it would just get down to the old golden rule. I think that that's what Rice lived by, and his idea of an even break in anything was giving the other fellow just a little bit of an edge.
In his younger days, he was called Grant, but I always called him Granny. Well, just how would you describe Granny Rice? It would take an artist's eye to do that, like that of famed cartoonist Rube Goldberg.
He was a fella about 6 feet tall, never cared about clothes. He generally wore blue suits, and he wouldn't go to the tailor's. I think his wife had to drag him. And he wore kind of battered hats and just shirts. I mean, his clothes were undistinguishable. There was nothing about them that you would recognize as something that was selected with any care. He just put clothes on. He had nice features. He had fine features. Very delicate nose and mouth, and his ears stuck out a little, and he lost his hair in later years. But he had a very kind face. He never got excited. He walked along a little bit stooped with a slight shuffle. And I'd say he was a very gentle, nice-looking man.
It's strange what you remember about a friend. His smile, perhaps, or his voice, or maybe his preferences in food.
If we would lose Granny in the crowd, the surest way to find him would be to follow a waiter that have in a tray clam chowder, always clam chowder, a dill pickle, a cracker, a piece of cheese, and a martini cocktail.
That from Frank Stevens, president of the Harry M. Stevens Catering Company. That's the outfit that sells the hot dogs and soda pop and other refreshments at most of our great sporting events. A sports reporter is a nomad, as portable as the typewriter he carries. His professional life is a round of crowded press boxes, steaming locker rooms, and lonely hotel rooms. He deals with younger men engrossed in physical exertion. He lives with men who have seen too many games and have been away from home too much. Henry Grantland Rice never became cynical about the games and the people he covered. He always retained the small boy's wide-eyed wonderment and enthusiasm about athletics. He was a hero worshiper, but in his profession, Granny Rice made the greatest single contribution to sports writing. He gave it class. When Granny started out, sports reporting was regarded by most newspaper editors as a stepchild of journalism. How did Granny help change that attitude?
A man of his character and ability couldn't help making a vast contribution to sports writing as a career.
John Kieran, former sports columnist of the New York Times.
And I think that two things happened through Grantland Rice. First was the impress of his own character, certainly influenced everybody who came in contact. And in the second place, the fine style of writing that he introduced to the sports page has been an influence on all sports writers since. He really put literature on the sports page.
Herbert Bayard Swope, former editor of the New York World, worked with Granny during his early days.
Rice and I worked alongside of each other, but Rice stayed a sports reporter. He stayed in the field of happiness. He'd rather not have a story than to have one that hurt somebody. And he didn't become maudlin in his praise. He was discriminating. His comments upon ball players were sound and searching. He was a man of great regularity. Whether he'd have a couple of beers 10 minutes before he began his assignment or the night before, he was always OTJ, as they used to say in the Navy when I was in it, which means on the job. And he was, in capital letters. He never failed to meet a deadline. Can any newspaper man be paid a higher compliment?
Most other newspaper men claim that sports writers have the softest jobs in the world. Just show up at the ballpark, take a few notes on the game, pick up a press handout from the publicity man, bang out their story, and get home in time for supper. Maybe some do, but Granny didn't play it that way.
He was such a student of all the things that he wrote about.
Tris Speaker, the old gray eagle of the Cleveland Indians.
He wanted to know why you did certain things. He wanted to know why you would move on certain batters. And then he felt that he could write very intelligently about those batters. He would ask Bobby Jones why he would stand ahead of a golf ball or back of it. He was a real good golfer. He had a 4 handicap and could shoot to it. He would go around that golf course with anybody at any time, including Bobby Jones. He was a student of the game that he wrote about. He was a student of the game that he played. And he wanted to know all the answers. Why do you do these things and what causes the ball to do certain things?
The noted author, Clarence Buddington Kellen, traveled around with Granny for many years and observed him at work.
One friendship that Granny and I had that was very valuable to both of us, and that was our lifelong friendship with Bobby Jones. Oh, for 20-odd years, I don't think there was an important golf tournament in the United States which Grant and Bobby and I didn't attend together. Bobby and I were lazy. We'd find a place on the golf course where we could see three or four holes, and we'd sit there and enjoy each other and the golf tournament. But not so Granny. He had his job to do, and no matter how tired his legs were, or how hot the day, or how disagreeable the weather, Granny would be out all day long following golfers all over the golf course. He had to see it with his own eyes and not have anybody tell him about it. In my life, I've known and been very fond of a great many newspaper men. A great many of them have been so good as to ask me to do their column for them at some time or other. But not Granny. No matter how tired Granny was, no matter what tough day we'd put in, no matter what happened, Granny would never let anybody lay a finger on his column. Nobody but Grantland Rice ever wrote a thing under the name of Grantland Rice.
Granny Rice was born November 1st, 1880, in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, a state that produced such men as Andrew Jackson, Davy Crockett, and Sam Houston. He was named Henry Grantland after his grandfather, a cotton planter and Civil War hero who fought as a major in the Confederate Army. Granny's family sent him to military prep school when he was in his teens, and there he fell in love with football. Next stop, college.
Dynamite, dynamite, when Bandy starts to fight.
Vanderbilt University in Nashville, where Granny distinguished himself on the sports field and in the classroom. Professor Jim Robbins, now retired, recalls Granny's college days.
Well, Grantland Rice, who had spent his boyhood around Nashville, entered Vanderbilt almost a decade after I blew in from Gundown, Mississippi. 1888 for me, 1897 for him. With a real affection for football, Grantland made a genuine attempt to play the game for Vanderbilt in his freshman year. In fact, he kept it up for 3 years. And succeeded in winning a letter in his junior year. He finally concluded that he was physically unfit for the game, in which he had made no marked success. His top weight in his undergraduate years was 134. His string bean aspect seemed to fit him exactly for handling baseballs from the shortstop's position. In his last year, he was captain. His top game was against Tennessee in Knoxville. 15 aces, no errors, a home run, and a double. Vanderbilt won 4-3.
We'll sing a song for that flag today. Cheer for the team.
He majored in Latin and Greek. He made Phi Beta Kappa grades. Grantland had what I consider the tip-top philosophy, for when the one great scorer comes to mark against your name, he writes not that you won or lost, but how you played the game. In later years, he has said that he's been very frequently roasted and maybe toasted for a piece of verse that he wrote years ago. I'll stick with him just on general principles.
The summer after graduation, young Rice barnstormed through Tennessee with a semi-pro baseball team. Then he got his first newspaper job, sports editor with the Nashville Daily News. He also covered the state capitol, the markets, and the customs house. Salary, $5 a week. Here, Granny first put to use his talent for poetry, turning out the first samples of his rhythmic newspaper copy.
To really appreciate Grantland Rice, I think a person has to go back to the old newspaper files when he was writing here in Nashville back in 1906 and 1908, 1910, when he himself was the entire staff.
Again, Fred Russell, sports editor of the Nashville Banner.
It was nothing for him to bat out a long poem. You would know that he had to do these poems within a very few minutes because he did everything else on the sports page. He wrote all the heads and edited all the copy and did the rewrites and still was able to come up with a very timely poem. poem to fit almost any occasion. It was just a gift with him. He was one of the very first athletes to become a sports writer. And I really believe that his athletic background had a great influence on the nature of his writing and maybe the psychology. Having been an athlete, Rice brought to sports a new type of writing. I received a letter recently from a teammate of his on the Vanderbilt baseball team of 1901. In this letter, he said the Nashville team of 1902 wanted to sign Grantland Rice, but that his father and his grandfather frowned on a professional career, and they discouraged him from that.
Newspapermen were always on the move back in those days. I guess they still are today. And then, as now, the ambition of most newspapermen was to head north to the major league cities for the big league assignments and the big league stories. Granny was no exception. He arrived in Cleveland to become sports editor of the Cleveland News. One of the men who came to work for Granny was Ed Bang, the present sports editor of the News and, since Granny's death, the dean of the nation's sports writers.
I was on the Youngstown Telegram, sports editor down there, and then I came up to meet Grantland, and I was so impressed with him that I sacrificed considerable money to get into the big league. That was in 1907. Granny had been up here since 1905. Now, Granny, one of the things he told me when I took over the job, he says, Ed, he says, there's one thing you want to bear in mind. He said, all newspaper men should ever have it in mind, and that is this. He says, if a ball player makes a mistake, a football player pulls a bone or a fighter a little bit short, don't riddle him with bullets. Just think of the same mistakes that you made that day. And I think it was the best advice that anybody ever gave me.
Granny Rice never regarded athletes as just cold-blooded copy. He was always trying to help them, either in print or in person. Johnny Kilbane, the Silver Fox of Cleveland and world featherweight champion of the world for over a decade, still recalls the advice Granny gave him nearly 50 years ago.
I remember the first time I met him. I was boxing. Of course, I was against amateurs. We're getting $2.50, which was a lot of money, you remember those days. Granny called me aside, and we sat over in the corner, and he says, young man, he said, I want to tell you, you've got a lot of speed, you're a fine-looking fellow. He said, but you look kind of skinny, and those legs are awful spindly. You've got to keep going fast. I said, well, Mr. Rice, I said, I happen to be a sort of a dancer, a buck dancer. He said, well, that's wonderful. But he said, let me tell you something. You have to have power, he said, Johnny. Without power, you can't exist. I said, well, what will I do? He said, well, power comes from the ball of your foot. And the next thing I want you to keep in mind is, the boxing game is not for you to get in there and get hit. The first thing you should learn about boxing is, make the other fellow miss. Years after then, occasionally in New York, every place I'd go, we'd always come to the back room, we'd sit down and go out and have a little corned beef and cabbage. It was quite a storyteller when he got a belly full of that, boy.
Well, if Johnny didn't remember that corned beef and cabbage, his name wouldn't be Kilbane. Granny felt he was making enough money in Cleveland, so he decided to get married. The girl was Kate Hollis, Kit to Granny, of Americus, Georgia. They had met while Granny was working on the Atlanta Journal. In 1907, Granny left the sports pages of the Cleveland News in the hands of Ed Bang, returned to Nashville as sports editor of the Nashville Tennessean, a new paper just starting operation. He also coached the Vanderbilt baseball team. Then, 3 years later, New York, the big town and the big time beckoned. And Granny headed north again to work for the New York Evening Mail. The salary was lower than what he got in Nashville. But New York was the place to be if you were a newspaper man, and particularly if you were a sports writer. This was Mecca. This was where the top newspaper men congregated, and the top athletes. Granny liked New York. One of the lifelong friends he made in Manhattan was John Wheeler, a reporter for the New York Herald, and now head of the North American Newspaper Alliance.
When World War I broke out, Grant, who was well beyond the draft age, went back to Tennessee and volunteered as a private. He was soon commissioned as an officer and went abroad following some fighting at the front. He was assigned to the Stars and Stripes, the military publication as a combat correspondent. In this capacity, he was associated with Harold Ross, who later became editor of the New Yorker magazine, and Alexander Wolcott. Until his death, Harold Ross always addressed Rice as lieutenant, since he finished the war as a first lieutenant, and Grant always addressed Ross as Private Ross.
While serving in France, Granny saw a young Marine named Gene Tunney punch his way to the light heavyweight championship of the AEF. They formed a friendship that continued through the 20s, the golden age of sports, and for years after. Yes, it was great to be a working sports reporter, to be in New York in the 20s. Everything was big. The stock market, the bootleggers, the skyscrapers were going up. Every game had its hero. Babe Ruth, Bobby Jones, Red Grain, Jack Dempsey, Gene Tunney. Granny Rice knew them all, wrote about them all. He helped build them into heroes with his typewriter. He was a hero worshiper, but he himself was worshipped by his own heroes. Like former heavyweight champion of the world, Gene Tunney.
I boxed Tom Gibbons in New York on June 5th, 1925 in the Polo Grounds. Grantland covered the fight, and his lead was the ghost of Bella Woods, the feats, the phantom of St. Paul. Of course, the ghost of Bella Woods was the Marines who died fighting in Bella Woods in that bloody battle. And Gibbons' boys were called phantoms of St. Paul because they were so quick and elusive and yet so decisive in action.
And remember the four horsemen of Notre Dame? Here's Don Miller of that great backfield.
If it hadn't been for the fact that he tagged us as the four horsemen of Notre Dame, our backfield and our team would have been forgotten a year or two after that. And now it's 30 years since we play. And even today, we receive at least 50 invitations each year to appear at different football banquets throughout the country. It was not only that our lives in the sport world had been extended to the present time, but the fact that he named us the Four Horsemen was responsible for many of the business successes that the four of us have attained, because that name has really opened the doors in many directions for us.
The other halfback was Jim Crowley.
I met Grantland Rice in the fall of 1923 in October. That was the day that we played the Army in Brooklyn at Ebbets Field. Newt Rockne introduced all of us boys to him. And that was the day that he got the idea of calling us the Four Horsemen. Notre Dame had the ball, and we started an end sweep. So our backfield was chased out of bounds, and we were going very fast when we hit the sidelines, though. And we had to jump over the people on the bench, and all four of us jumped over Grantland Rice. So he turned to his friend, and with a pale look, he says, "They remind me of the Four Horsemen." But he didn't give us the name until the following year, another October game in 1924. And Granny was sitting high up in the press box, this time at the Polo Grounds. And he wrote his opening lead. Outlined against a blue-gray October sky, the Four Horsemen rode again. In dramatic lore, they are known as death, pestilence, famine, and war. But these are only aliases. Their real names are Stuhldreher, Crowley, Miller, and Layden. The name of the Four Horsemen is as great today as it was back in 1924. I feel that Granny Rice naming us the Four Horsemen has immortalized us in a football way. And if we hadn't been named the Four Horsemen, I am sure that we would have been just another fairly good backfield that was turned out by the Fighting Irish of Notre Dame.
Away from the sports arena, Granny liked to relax. Among his many recreations, he was fond of hunting, but with certain reservations. One of his favorite hunting companions was Frank Stevens.
I have hunted with him in Nova Scotia, Maine, North and South Carolina, and he was always a grand companion. But Grant was never a fellow to climb over the mountains and through the dales and get up early in the morning. I would consider Grant a very gentle hunter. He did not like to kill game, but he would go with the boys and not interfere with their pleasure. If they were successful in bringing in a moose, a bear, a deer, he was always delighted. He did his little stuff around the camp. If we needed any wood and carry the water or help to cook, And he wasn't averse to mixing his cocktail for the whole trip.
To Granny, hunting was a cruel sport. But many people consider prize fighting a cruel sport. And it is. Yet, Granny was very fond of boxing.
You ask me what attracted Grant and Rice to prize fighting?
Again, Gene Tunney.
Grant, like a great many of the poets of the past, intellectualized boxing. Bernard Shaw wrote the finest book on boxing ever written, Cashel Byron's Profession. Lord Byron boxed every day with his instructor, Gentleman Jackson, who had been heavyweight champion of England. Poets all the way down through history have loved the cheek-by-jowl a quality of prize fighting, the greatest reporting ever done in history of the world, was by Homer, and it was mostly about prize fights. Granny followed the custom of the eternal poet. He intellectualized and glamorized prize fighting. Grantland was a poet first in everything. He was a poet first. Only he amongst the sports writers would know of the golden age of Greece. That was the time of Pericles. So Grant and Rice referred to the decade of 1920 to 1930 as the golden age of sports. I not only admired Grant's poetry, but I, more than anything about Grant, I admired his memory. He and Billy Phelps and I had a spring and fall golf game in New Haven. William Lyon Phelps was a professor of literature in Yale. After every shot, they'd be quoting poetry from Keats, Shelley, the great poets of the past. And Grantland on poetry was comparable to John Kieran. He knew his poetry. And of course, he sang it so beautifully.
John Kieran talks about Granny's own poetry.
Well, it's what you call a homely verse, sentimental, but it's good sentiment and it's good verse, and I think it certainly will last. Grant knew that he wasn't writing as well as Shakespeare or Keats or Shelley, because he knew them and he loved them, but at least he was following in their footsteps and he was giving way to the same urge that they had to sing. He was a very wise man, of great integrity and principle. And when other big men of the country met him through their interest in sports, they were immediately impressed with the fact that he was just as big a man in a way of character and intelligence and integrity as any man they ever met.
On that same subject, Rube Goldberg.
He was a great friend of Teddy Roosevelt, the son of Theodore. This was Teddy Jr., and they both were great students of poetry. And I've sat down with them at the little club we belong to, the Coffee House Club, and they would be exchanged. It'd be almost a contest as to see which one could remember certain classics correctly, and they would rattle off poetry by the hour. I heard him recite Longfellow's Endymion right through, and also some of Swinburne's ballads, and he would go right through to the end without missing a word.
And then there was a little group which included among its members sports cartoonist Willard Mullen of the New York World Telegram and Sun. This was the Village Green Reading Society.
Wait, maybe I shouldn't bring this up. The Village Green Reading Society is sort of like Berzelius or Skull and Bones. If you should mention that name in my company, I have to get up and leave the room. But we'll skip that. Now the society is not truly active since Granny's gone. But like Topsy, it just growed. When Herman left the point, Herman Hickman left the point to go to Yale, take head coach job there, Granny said, we ought to go up there and see old Herman. Well, it just happened that Tim Cohane and Red Smith, Frank Graham, and myself got with Granny and drove up there. We went out to see practice and then repaired to Herman's little shack, as he says he's too poor to paint and too proud to whitewash. But we sure did turn out some good meals up there. Granny Rice's big contribution, he'd buy a watermelon and plug it and then turn a bottle of bourbon upside down in it and leave that all day. That was sort of dessert. But after this dinner, we would all sit around and read poetry. Granny Rice, of course, didn't have to learn anything. He could talk in poetry. I wouldn't say the spirit would have to be on him, but I've seen him. We'd be in a general conversation, and all of a sudden he'd come out with a quatrain that was right pertinent to the subject that we were discussing, and it would scan and be to the point, too.
Grantland Rice. Tonight's Biography in Sound will be continued after a 10-second pause for station identification. Now, to continue our Grantland Rice story, here again is your narrator, Tom Manning.
In his later years, Granny became fond of playing the horses. He spent much of his free time at the tracks. One of his favorite companions around the racetracks was the man who is now head of Churchill Downs, sports columnist Bill Corum.
Granny didn't start coming to the races until late in his career. He liked to play the daily double, for instance. And I can recall a time at Hialeah when he threw a bunch of tickets. He was very careless. He threw a bunch of tickets on the floor, and the late Joe Palmer, a great racing writer, just out of curiosity, started picking them up and said, here, some of these tickets are winners. By this time, Granny had walked off, so Palmer went down and cashed the tickets, some $300 or $400 worth, and came back and stuffed it in Granny's pocket. And that was typical. I'm sure that the snoopers, that they call them at the racetrack, could have done very well following Granny around. Because he played so many horses, he didn't know quite what he was playing much of the time.
Another frequent companion at the tracks, baseball great Hank Greenberg, general manager of the Cleveland Indians.
In the winter, I saw him frequently, about six times a week, at Hialeah. While Granny and I tried to pick the winners, it wasn't a question of money because Granny's reputation as a bettor was $2. And he had just enjoyed the satisfaction of being able to determine who was going to cross the finish line first before the race ran. And his way of doing it was a process of elimination. He would ask for tips and try to dope out the horses that wouldn't run, and then he'd finally get down to the last three and bet on those.
Well, I guess that's one way of picking them. I guess everybody has his own system. There are many stories about Granny at the racetrack. All his friends have their own particular favorite. This one from sports columnist Red Smith.
We used to go south together almost every spring, and one of Granny's favorite places was little old kind of beat-up Sunshine Park down outside Tampa, Florida. We'd go there together. It's a kind of shoeless Joe of a racetrack, a clearing among the palmetto thickets. And Granny loved the place for its informality and all. One time they named the daily double after Granny. They called the first race the Grantland and the second race the Rice because Granny, who loved to play the horses anyhow, had a special affection for the daily double. He used to buy tickets of every conceivable color and combination in the double. So it turned out that he had two tickets still alive after the first race, which, had he won, would have been worth about $1,200. And good, deeply devoted horse player that he was excited going for that $1,200. But his horse was beaten by a nose in the second race. Now, he had agreed to go out on the track after the second race, in the winner's circle, rather, and to present a trophy to the jockey who won the second race and completed the double. So he was out there, bleeding, of course, from the heart, and the jockey was saying to him, "Mr. Rice, my horse was trying to quit all the way down the stretch. I had everything I could do to hold him together." And Granny, smiling benignly for the photographs and presenting the trophy, was saying softly, "Why didn't you let him quit, you little rascal? Why didn't $1,200?
Well, I guess, like everybody else, Granny hated to lose those close ones. Now, we mentioned a short while ago that sports reporters do a lot of traveling. Granny traveled a lot, all over the country. But traveling with Granny had its problems. Bill Corum knows about that.
Granny wasn't a man of tremendous sense of humor, nor was he a fellow who created stories. He was just the one that most of us liked the most, I'd say. Sure, we had arguments, but it was the sort of arguments in which nobody was mad. He always liked to travel in a little gang. He was never a fellow who wanted to be alone. And partially, I guess, that explains one of his weaknesses. If he had been alone, he probably would have missed more trains than any man had ever lived, because he was careless about time and sort of childish about getting a reservation and which station the train was going from or which airfield the plane was flying from. And he sort of did need, in that sense, somebody to take care of him, competent as he was in his own field.
Grant wasn't a fellow who planned things very carefully.
Clarence Buddington Kelland.
For instance, if we were going down to Columbus, Ohio, to see Texas Christian and Ohio State play football, Granny would call up and say, "Well, meet me at such and such a train tonight." Well, I'd meet him at such and such a train, and then when we got there, we'd discover that the train went from the Pennsylvania Station instead of the Grand Central, at which we were present. I remember once we got down to Columbus to see this football game. It was a terrible day. Raining, blowing, it was almost a hurricane. And we had to walk from our hotel out to the stadium where the game was because we couldn't find a taxi cab. And we got to the gate, and Granny pulled the tickets from out of his pocket and handed them to the man at the gate. And the man looked at him and looked at Granny and looked at me and said, "These are no good here. These are tickets to the polo games at Meadowbrook, Long Island."
Great as he was and famous as he was, he never realized that he was a celebrity.
New York Journal-American columnist Frank Graham.
Granny also was very careless about tickets. He had a secretary to get the tickets for him and actually pin them in his pocket during the World Series between the Browns and the Cardinals. We got out of the cab at the ballpark, and he discovered he had the wrong ticket with him for the game this day, and he said, "What can I do?" And I said, "Follow me." So I went up the first gate, and I said to the gate tender, "This is Grantlin Rice. Right behind me, he's got the wrong ticket." And the man punched my ticket and leaned over and said, "Mr. Rice, how are you? I'm so glad to know you. I've been reading you for years and always enjoyed your columns," and shook hands with him. And now Granny's in the ballpark. We had one more turnstile to pass through. When we got to that one, the same thing. I said, "This is Grantlin Rice," right behind me. And the man said, "Hello, Mr. Rice. Would you give me your autograph?" And of course, Granny gave him his autograph. And now he's practically in the press box, and he turned to me and he said, "You've got a lot of influence around here, haven't you?"
Sports columnist Red Smith.
I think of the time when Notre Dame was playing Army in one of those spectacular games in the Yankee Stadium, the games that always sold out and when tickets were at such a tremendous premium. Granny's tickets, his working press tickets, somehow went astray in the mail. And he discovered that with very little time to spare, and typically, characteristically, he went down onto Broadway instead of hollering at somebody, "Please get me in." He went down to Broadway and bought a ticket from a speculator at premium price, of course. Then he went up in the stands and sat there among the crowd with his typewriter on his knees until the game was over, and apologetically begged his way into the press box afterwards to write his story. The press box where Granny belonged, if anyone else in the world did. He was, after all, the dean and the boss of all the rest. He never seemed to appreciate that he was the big man he was, because I remember when I heard that story about the Army Notre Dame game, I howled, "Granny, why didn't you throw some weight around?" Granny said, "Well, to tell the truth, I don't weigh much."
Granny had the happy faculty of making you believe that you were one of his closest personal friends. And, come to think of it, you were. Granny knew an awful lot of people. They were all his friends. Not just sports people, but folks in every walk of life. Businessmen, for instance, like Coca-Cola's president, William E. Robinson.
In the years I knew him, he knew more people of all kinds outside the sports world than any reporter I ever knew, whether sports or otherwise. Knowing so many people of all kinds, he understood people better. I think this enabled him to write with better insight into their interests in whatever game he was covering. This knowledge of people, which came to him because people liked him and people sought him out and people of all kinds did, was of course one of the things that contributed greatly to the fact that he was always a happy man.
Now, I don't want you to get the idea that Granny Rice was always full of sweetness and light. You had to stay on your toes around him. Ask Willard Bullen.
Well, Granny is pictured as being the very paragon of virtue. He was, I guess. But a lot of pixie in him, too. He had a lot of wonderfully dull needles that he would stick in people and sit back and laugh. Well, he would get fun out of any situation that there was. And he was a great competitor, as you know. But if he did happen to lose, which was occasionally, he didn't lose often, he lost gracefully, but look out for him the next time. A little bit of bulldog in him, too. He was a fighter in a gentle way, let's say. He was innately polite. I'm sure Granny just liked people. But he could dislike people, too. But he wouldn't be rude. He just would have nothing to do with them.
You want to hear a story, a dramatic story, which has never been told before?
Tommy Armour, one of the immortals of golf.
He wrote a story about a certain man. I didn't like the story. It was true to the Wright's tradition of building a guy up. But the build-up was absolutely false. But Grant didn't think so. I wrote a rebuttal in another magazine. And if you don't think that caused a sensation, Armour and Rice, dearest friends, writing stories about each other. And I put Grant on the fan. I really put him on the fan. A man who had written more nice things about me than any 50 people in the world. Some justified, some came out of his generous, lovely mind. I accused him of writing a thing which was wrong, was false. And it was. Time marched on, a couple of months. We met at a gathering point, and here we were, head to head, face on. He passed me. He didn't talk to me. If you don't think that cut me right to my Scotch heart, that cut. We lived on the same floor. I went up to go to my room. He was leaving his room, and we walk along the corridor, and we face each other. Nobody in the place. Just he and I, in the dark corridor. He was just going to pass me. I said, Grant, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with life and man. If people who like each other as much as you and I do can't have a difference of opinion, there's something wrong. He put out his hand. He said, Tommy, I was wrong.
Yes, Granny was a very human guy. He had a tiny streak of vanity, and he had a right to it. But he had an awful lot of integrity. NEA sports editor Harry Grayson can fill you in on that.
Grandon Rice had that wonderful dignity that made everybody look up to him. As in later years, we called him the Dean, and he rather liked it. He liked it. He didn't care for an off-color story. He liked an amusing story, but he'd walk out on anything that wasn't absolutely legitimate. I remember they signed Billy Kahn and Joe Louis to box a benefit show. Grandon Rice was chairman of the committee, and Jacobs, the promoter, agreed to let them box with 100% charity show. When it developed that Lewis owed Jacobs $100,000+ in tax money, and Kahn had borrowed money from Jacobs, and Jacobs wanted that money back, Grant and Rice just walked out of the room. If any deal in his book wasn't absolutely right and legitimate, he wanted no truck with it.
Granny Rice could handle a typewriter with the best of them. In fact, I believe he was one of the fastest writers in the business. The typewriter was one mechanical gadget he could cope with. But some of the other modern devices gave him trouble. Frank Graham used to help out.
Well, in 1950, at the World Series in Philadelphia, Granny had been ill just before that. Granny and Red Smith and I had a suite in the Bellevue, and the manager sent up a large screen television set for us. So the next morning, he wasn't feeling well at all, and I insisted he not go to the ballpark, that he stay back at the hotel and see the game on television, since he didn't have to be at the ballpark, since he didn't have to write a play-by-play story. He could see the game on there, write a story, call a messenger, and get it off. Well, he finally, but reluctantly, agreed to do it, and then said, but I don't know how to turn on the television set. So I left it on. So Bill Corm and I came back from the game, and going up to our room, walking down the hall, Bill said, Granny must have company. And I said, no. He said, I hear voices coming from there. I said, it's the television set. He doesn't know how to turn it off. So here was Granny sitting in front of the television set, looking at something, either Howdy Doody or a similar performance. And I said, how was the ball game? Well, the ball game was wonderful. The rest of the stuff has been terrible. And I said, why didn't you turn it off? And he said, I don't know how to turn it off. And just then Red Smith came in, and hearing that, said it wasn't that. He was just too polite to turn the set off and walk out on the actors.
Red Smith.
If ever I knew anyone who could do very little besides type and play golf with his hands, it was Granny. In the days that I knew him, his fingers, his mechanical gifts were, well, somewhat more than limited. Copy readers who were on the desks handling his copy in Granny's younger days have told me that it was immaculate. It was just remarkably clean. And if they were pressed on deadline, it was never necessary to edit his copy, to go through it for corrections, because there were almost surely not going to be any errors. They'd grab the copy and railroad it right to the composing room. By the time I knew him, arthritis had stiffened up his fingers a little bit, and I always had the impression, looking at his copy, that he had written it in longhand and edited it on the typewriter, because it seemed to me there were more longhand insertions than there were lines of typescript. His typewriter would jump a couple of spaces between letters, and he rattled on so fast. He was a remarkably fast writer.
Even in his late 60s and early 70s, Granny Rice kept up the pace, traveling all over the country, covering the major sports events. He held on to that enthusiasm he had as a Cub reporter just off the Vanderbilt campus. But his closest friends began to notice he was beginning to tire just a bit. Joe Stevens, executive vice president of the Stevens Catering Company, discovered this one night in 1953.
The time when it was first noticeable that Granny had lost quite a bit of ground was the night of the Marciano-Charles fight at the Yankee Stadium. As usual, Granny checked into our office quite a while before the semifinal. He'd probably there an hour before the main bout was to go on. When it came time for the main bout to go, he says, I'm tired. And we had one of our top men take him and carry his typewriter to his seat in the working press. This was the first time that there had been real evidence of that Granny had not quite up to himself physically.
Early in the 1930s, Granny Rice had joined the North American Newspaper Alliance, headed by John Wheeler, his old friend from the early reporting days in New York. Granny's column was distributed by the NANA from that time until his death on July 13, 1954.
Grantin Rice lived a happy life and never seemed to be afraid of death. I suppose he contemplated it as anyone who passes 70, but he didn't fear it. I believe he looked at it as Henry Mancken did, the inescapable last act. Grant's last column was released for publication Monday, July 19th, a few days after his death. Since he wrote on a schedule that required preparing most of his work 4 or 5 days in advance. The title of the column, The Spotlight, his final effort is headed, They're Always Replaced. It begins, as old stars in baseball fade out, the gaps are filled largely from the most unexpected spots on the map.
John Wheeler had the sad duty of writing 30 on Granny's last column.
Shortly after Granny Rice died, I had a letter from his great friend John McNulty, the writer, who used to go to the races a good deal with Granny. John wrote,
Granny always seemed to me to be a saint who drank dry martinis and bet on horses. I didn't mean to be irreverent because I guess under the horse plane and the rise of plain water on the side and swear words now and then, I may be a kind of religious man. Saints, I think, must have been people who had hardly any faults, possibly none at all, although I don't believe that. And saints must have been people who did a lot of good for other people, preferably without a great hullabaloo about it. Just the same, I think I'd be nervous and pretty self-conscious if I were ever hanging around with any of the saints I read about or heard about. Those saints are so good they'd make me nervous, make me feel like a heel and a bum, probably. That wasn't the way it was with Granny. He measured up to my own personal definition of a saint. A jolly, companionable one, and it was enormous fun to be with. For one thing, I don't think Granny ever hurt anybody in his life. You can go through the thousands of columns he wrote, and I bet you won't find 10 knocks. And if there are 10 knocks, then the odds are 6-2 and even that they were against real, certified, age-in-the-wood heels and no good nicks. So he's a saint, all right, Granny was. A nice, easy-going, easy-to-be-with saint. And without half trying, too.
Grantland had what I consider the tip-top philosophy. For when the one great scorer comes to mark against your name, he writes not that you won or lost, but how you played the game.
Friend, this has been the story of Grantland Rice, a man who believed that good sportsmanship was a way of life. I suppose that many of you listening in knew Granny. If so, I hope we brought back some fond memories. But if you never knew Grantland Rice, well, you missed something. This is Tom Manning. Granny, wherever you are, thanks and good night.
You've been listening to another transcribed feature of NBC's Biographies in Sound, presented every week at this time. They Knew Grantland Rice was written and edited by Elliot Frankel and Pat Tracy, produced under the supervision of Arthur Wakely for NBC News. Your narrator was Tom Manning of WTAM Cleveland.